Now you've actually got the finished album in front of you and you can actually go home and listen to it yourself, how does it rate for you compared to Iron Maiden albums of the past?
I feel, it's funny, after recording, I always feel the same way. It's like, this is definitely the best album that we've done, you know. And to me, it's the same with Somewhere in Time, you know. It feels like we've actually gone a step further.
Is it as you imagined it might have been before you actually got in and started writing and recording?
You never know, it's the exciting thing about it. You never know how it's going to turn out, how people are going to react to, you know, what you've got, and, you know, everyone's going to be putting in their ideas, so it's quite exciting. You never know how it's going to turn out. You've got a rough idea because, you know, we've done 5 or 6 albums before.
Mm.
But I think this is the best album we've done.
This album, I think, is... There's not a track on the album I can say that I'm unhappy with, you know. Whether the individual tracks are stronger than others, it's difficult to be objective.
Mm.
I think they're really, really strong. I think it's a very, very powerful album. But as an overall album, I would say it's probably the best thing we've done probably since the first album, I would say.
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ, and joining me is frequent and favorite guest of the show and author of Van Halen Rising, Greg Renoff. Hey, Greg.
Hey, BJ. Thanks for having me back on once again.
Thank you for coming back. I always try to find an excuse to get you to come back on.
This is a good one. I'm really excited to talk about this record.
So yesterday was your birthday, right?
It was, yes.
So happy birthday.
thank you. I am 47 years young, and which puts me right into the right era to talk about this record, Somewhere in Time, because it... Yeah, it came out while I was in high school, and it was sort of the Maiden record that was, along with Power Slave, the ones that kind of really were the ones that I remember from high school. Those are the ones that came out.
Right. And I guess you do not know what today is. This is crazy, but we scheduled this weeks ago, right, to record on this day.
Right.
This day, right now today, September 29th, 2016, is literally the 30th anniversary of the day, the very day that this record came out.
Well, I mean, it's got to be.
So, that's...
Oh my, I'm looking at it right now. Unbelievable.
That's
how
ridiculous,
about that?
Isn't it? I saw that last night and I was like, that is... If I believed in, you know, signs and whatever, that would, you know, that would make you think. But I guess in the real world, we just call it a coincidence. But that is, what are the odds of that? That's kind of crazy.
I'm looking at it right now. Wow. 29 September 1986. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
That's crazy. But yeah, cool. 30th anniversary of this record coming out. And yeah, I clearly remember when this album came out. I guess I was 12 years old and... I remember Wasted Years being all over MTV, and well, I guess this was the first album where I was aware of the band when it was new, you know? Yeah, so the World Slavery Tour, well, we talked on the last episode about how that was the band's most ambitious tour yet. 13 consecutive months, 28 countries, and then they put out a live album and a VHS. Of course, back then, you know, bands put out... That was probably pretty early in the... phenomenon of bands putting out VHS tapes, but
you know, I think too, I was just thinking about this, is that this tour, if you look at the tour dates for the Somewhere on tour, which starts in September and runs through the early summer of the following year, Maiden is such a huge global phenomenon, as everybody knows, that that's really, they only need to play like, you know, 10 shows in the US and they can tour the world and have a great make a great living on that. I assume they're all making good money doing that. It's because they played all these countries. You know, they really, unlike some other bands from the 80s who just focused on the U.S. or, you know, Europe was every other year and they did the U.S. every year, they just went and toured everywhere. Italy, Switzerland, West Germany, France, Portugal, Spain, Belgium, Netherlands, it's Norway. I mean, it's Scotland. That's Poland. That is paying huge dividends now for them. I think that's, you know, the reason why. It's just you show up in these countries, you put on good shows, and years later people remain fans and bring their kids, and it's I'm sure at the time it must have been brutal to do these tours, to look at these dates and the amount of travel. It's not, you know, it's not a bus running around the U.S. for 2 months, which is bad enough, I'm sure, for musicians, hard enough. They just went everywhere in the world, so it's a great testament to how hard they wanted to work to become a global phenomenon.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it wasn't a 13-month tour. It was 13 straight months. And, yeah, 28 countries is crazy. And, yeah, I think another reason that Maiden are so popular in other parts of the world is just, for one, they're, like, such a unique, original band. They're this theatrical band. They've got Eddie. They've got all these different elements that make them the kind of band that has a rabid fan base. And yet, like, their fan base in South America and places, you know, is just famously huge. And yeah, so yeah, to this day, they're still just able to tour, you know, consistently and draw big crowds. And I guess just a testament to how unique and individual they are as a band, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so, you know, they put out the live album. You know, this they skip a year here as far as studio releases, because Power Slave's 84, Somewhere in Time's 86, but in between they had the live record, the double live album, which was, I think it went to number 4 in the UK and number 19 in the US, and it was their third straight platinum album in the US, so it was a big success. And they came off that tour and they took a 4-month break, which I read it was supposed to be a 6-month break. Got shortened to a 4-month break, but they took some time off before they went back into this studio. And and then when they go into this studio, this ends up being the most expensive album for them ever to record. But it also, at the time, it ends up being their most successful. It's their first album to go double platinum. But, you know, we were talking on the Power Slave episode about how it sure seems like, in retrospect, it seems like Power Slave and Live After Death, that was the peak for Iron Maiden, and then it was kind of a downhill trajectory mm-hmm. from there. But, you know, at the time, Somewhere in Time went double platinum, and Wasted Years was as close as they got to a hit. I guess, from what I could tell, the song didn't actually chart in the U.S., but it was all over MTV, and it sure felt at the time like it was a hit. Maybe it's just that I was more aware at the time. You know, maybe it was the same with Run to the Hills and other songs, but I don't know. I remember at the time it seemed like Iron Maiden were breaking through with Wasted Years, and it seemed like it was their most prominent, at least in the States, you know. It seemed like that was their moment to the closest they got, I guess, to crossing over and having like a mainstream single.
I'm thinking you're right. It probably wasn't something that was going to get played on the radio very much. Wasted Years, it you know, may have been, but it didn't chart at all. That says something. The video was definitely played quite a bit. You know, but Maiden, you know, if you were a fan of metal and you spent your time watching the not just MTV, but some of those shows like Night Flight and Radio 1990, those late night video shows that were on like USA Network and these types of things, Run to the Hills and these other videos would be played pretty consistently. And so even though we don't consider Maiden to be a video band, I do remember that their videos rotated through those shows fairly frequently, even if the production value in some of those early videos is not exactly it's not exactly groundbreaking.
Yeah, definitely Maiden, as far as Milwaukee radio, you never heard Iron Maiden that I remember at all. So yeah, they did not get much radio play. That's the thing about Iron Maiden, is they don't really fit into any of the categories. There's really just, they're their own genre of heavy metal, really. There's plenty of bands that have copied them, but as far as, you know, there's only one Iron Maiden. You can't, there's not really anything else to compare them to besides the bands that copied them. So,
The other thing I was going to observe about Live After Death, I have a cousin who was a guy who was actually a little bit younger than me, but always was seemingly ahead of the curve on things. And he would get these tapes and they would come out. And I remember he had the Live After Death cassette and I had not heard the record. And, you know, that record more than anything else sold me on Maiden. I had heard the earlier stuff, but I didn't own any Maiden records. But that one I was just really enamored with. And the other thing too is I thought it really worked well as a live album for me personally. I don't, like, maybe you could talk about this too, is that there were a lot of tracks on that record that I had not heard from some of the, like, Killers and some of the stuff I had not heard before. And it sort of immediately made me want to go listen to those other records, those earlier records. So in terms of, you think about a live album, one of the things you want to do is you want to expose people to your earlier albums who they may not have heard the songs and thought it was a good song. And it just was, the production was so great on it. The performances were so good that were captured on it. And the songs, I mean, the song, as we know, the songs are great. And so I thought it was just a magnificent live album that, for me, a big Maiden fan.
Yeah, and what I read is I'm pretty sure that record is pretty much just one show, and they say no overdubs. So they recorded it over four nights at the Long Beach Arena.
Right.
But I think it says, I think Steve Harris or somebody in Mick Wall's book says it's pretty much just one show with no overdubs. So that, I mean, obviously that's not how most of the other live albums of the 70s and 80s were put together.
And it's brilliant. It really is brilliant. And I remember the cassette came out. I'm trying to remember the deal with the cassette that did it have an extra song on it or something that was sort of, that was not available on the album or something. I can't remember. There was something like another friend had the record, and you look at the record and there was a couple songs missing. I can't remember which ones they were, but it was just one of these things that was really kind of opened the door for me for Maiden and, you know, Power Slave and all the other stuff. Because I'm trying to remember, I feel like I listened to Live After Death before I heard Power Slave. I think that's right. So, wow. But yeah, what a great record Live After Death is.
Yeah. DX Ferris talked about how basically it's like their greatest hits album, you know, at the time. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much how it comes across. I mean, that, and that's how it worked for you, I guess. And I mean, I don't remember the sequence of when I heard stuff, but I know that just me, the way I am, I'm never really a big live album person. I'm just more into listening to the studio albums. I guess part of what I really appreciate is like the artistry of, you know, crafting a song in the studio as well. That's part of what I really like. So I hardly ever listen to live albums, really, personally. But I'm sure back then I listened to Live After Death. Yeah, but yeah, I don't think it was definitely wasn't as significant for me as it was for you. But I'm sure your story is probably much more common than mine as far as our age group and, you know, getting into Iron Maiden. I think, yeah, Live After Death probably was a gateway for a lot of people.
Well, that lets me segue into my Iron Maiden live story, which I want to tell, and it's full color.
Go for it.
Yeah. So we'll circle back and we can talk about the Somewhere in Time album. But Maiden, on the end of the Somewhere on Tour, ended up coming to New Jersey, and so they had like maybe 2 months left on the tour. And as we've mentioned, they had been on the road forever. And I only give the first names of my two friends who are along for me with this because we want to protect their current reputations. But we had secured quite a bit of beer, and we were quite prepared for the show. And we went, and I went with my friend Bill and my friend Paul, and I have quite the memories of the parking lot. It was one of these things that back in those days, you could get to shows pretty early. I'm not sure if it's still like that or not, but I remember we I can't remember the day of the show, but I feel like we drove almost straight from school. So we got out of school at like 2 o'clock. We drove to the Meadowlands and we're there by about 3:30. And of course the show doesn't start till 7:30 or whatever. So it was 4 hours of preparation for the concert, but there were already people there. I remember we pull in the parking lot, we open up the back, get the cooler out, and we're partying. And it was, you know, it was definitely a very, very rowdy Maiden crowd. And I wasn't, you know, I was nowhere, and I was a studs and, you know, denim metalhead. I wasn't that at all. I was much more, you know, kind of a mellower guy than that at the time. But there were, you know, it was definitely like the leather was out, the chains were out. It was definitely, a Maiden crowd. And as it got darker and darker, it just got rowdier and rowdier in the parking lot. People started lighting fires. Boxes were getting set on fire. I have this very distinct memory of this kid, you know, this kind of classic New Jersey Hesher kid in the denim jacket and the long hair, climbed this light pole in the parking lot at the Meadowlands. And he was about three quarters of the way up. He had shimmied his way up, and people started pushing these boxes. I think it was probably his friends at first as a joke. And so they'd put these boxes and they lit them on fire around the base of the pole. And before you know it, was a fairly large fire of like cardboard boxes and just like beer, you know, whatever, beer cans people were throwing in there and stuff. And the kid was stuck on the pole. He was up there, you know, and he wasn't in it like, you know. He was like just like kind of wrapped around the pole and holding on, so he wasn't like, you know, hanging by his fingertips or something, but he was like sort of wrapped himself around the pole like a monkey, and he was hanging up there. I remember going, oh, this is getting really interesting. And so this New Jersey State Police used to patrol the parking lot, but it was just, you know, there were so many kids. I remember the cars going by, and they just didn't really do anything to stop it. And so we were very whacked. I was very fucked up, and I went into the show. We went in, and the band, we went in for the opening act, and this band called Wasted with Pete Way.
Right.
They opened the show, and I had never heard them before, and I have only very, very vague recollections of what the show was like at that point. But my friend Paul was passed out, so we had gotten him in the show, but he was really drunk, and he was passed out of the seat. And so at the end of the show, the lead singer of the band, Wasted, says, "Stay wasted," and kind of puts his fist in the air, and they do this big crescendo at the end. And my friend Paul, who hasn't made a sound, he's like his head's been on down on his shoulder for the last hour, sticks his arm up and goes, "Yeah!" he woke up and for that, like cupped his head up, and then he like put his head back down. He got up for Maiden, but that was the end of him for that. But the show was spectacular. I remember it very well. They, as you know, anyone who's seen Maiden lately, they pull out all the stops with the pyrotechnics and the onstage scenery and everything, and Dickinson was running everywhere, and it was just a phenomenally powerful show. And I left super impressed with it. And you know, one of those shows you walk out and you go, "That was an awesome, great, great concert." So in the parking lot when we're leaving, it was definitely like a riot. There were people throwing bottles, and so that was definitely unnerving. I mean, no one's throwing bottles at us personally, but bottles were being flung through the air. There was all the screaming and yelling. I remember the fire truck showed up to put out some fires that had been set, and people were throwing bottles at the fire truck, which was, you knew it was getting dangerous. So we got out of there as quickly as we could. But the next day, I remember in the New Jersey Star Ledger, the Newark Star Ledger, which was the local New Jersey paper my family got, there was an article about the concert saying it was a riot. And later I learned, I heard an interview with Scott Ian of Anthrax, that his car had been turned over and destroyed by by the fans. So this is one of those concerts that ended up being, you know, the sort of backlash against heavy metal. When Ozzy played Madison Square Garden, the fans ripped out with Metallica. The fans cut the foam out of the seats and threw the foam covers onto stage. And this was one of those shows that sort of, you know, I remember going back to the Meadowlands after that, and they were a lot more police, and there, if I seem to remember too, that they would only let people into certain parking lots at first, and they sort of were doing much more crowd control in terms of not letting that happen again. But I'm happy to say that I survived that concert, but it was definitely extremely memorable event of my childhood.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Yeah, we left. I mean, it was, you know, it wasn't one of those rides where you're thinking like, okay, this crowd's going to come and beat us and rob us, but it was just, there were like groups of kids like rocking around, like throwing things and screaming and lighting fires, and you could just see it was just, you know, the sort of the madness of the pyrotechnics of the Maiden show. It kind of made it like a fire craze. I just remember there being fairly large fires set in the parking lot of just debris, you know, just like, you know, and I was just like, let's go. So we left, and yes, it was apparently a long night for Scott Ian, who ended up without a car.
And that was 86, so Anthrax already had a couple records out by then, probably, right?
Yeah, it probably wasn't like some like Chevy Nova from 76.
They were probably Anthrax fans, and they didn't even know they were overturning probably, the guy from Anthrax's probably, car.
Probably. I've never had the chance to ask Scott Ian about that, but I just remember reading about that later, that, you know, that kind of came out in something. It was pretty wild.
Yeah. Well, you have to think, if it was as crazy as it was before the show, it's only going to be worse after the show.
Oh, it was, yeah. Yeah, it was just sort of this laissez-faire attitude that the state police had, where they must have known that 90 to 80% of the kids in the parking lot were underage drinking. They just didn't do anything. I mean, it was just, you know, they just sort of like watched. And then I probably thought, well, how are we going to control this anyway? You know, there's no way to control a crowd like that.
Yeah, they don't have enough room in the jail for them all.
Those were the days, yes. So Bill and Paul, I will send this along to them. They were my co-conspirators in that night, and it was a fun teenage adventure. Yes, seeing Iron Maiden.
Hey!
arguably the end of their peak or the peak. I don't know what you'd say about this tour. They were extremely popular, despite the fact that they had changed their sound for this record.
Yeah, the synthesizers. But what is probably the most significant thing about the creation of this record is that we get zero writing credits from Bruce Dickinson. There's only one co-written song on the whole album, Dave Murray and Steve Harris, I think Deja Vu. Otherwise, there's four songs written just by Steve Harris and three songs written by just Adrian Smith. So I guess the reason that Bruce Dickinson doesn't get a writing credit is all his songs were rejected by Martin Birch and the band. Supposedly, Bruce, he wanted to go in a different direction. He was writing songs on acoustic guitar with more of a folky feel, and I have a quote from Bruce. He says, "If I had my way, the album would have sounded different. I just thought the time was right for us to do something audacious, something vast and daring, and I didn't feel we did that with Somewhere in Time. We just made another Iron Maiden album."
Which, in retrospect, was probably the right move, actually.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. But what's funny is if you look at what Martin Birch and Steve Harris were saying at the time, exactly what they wanted to do was make another Iron Maiden album. And Steve Harris says his quote about Bruce Dickinson is, "I just thought he'd completely lost the plot at the time." Mm. Well, Martin Birch, quote from him, he says, "I always sensed a slight danger of too much input from Bruce and Adrian because they were always in danger of kind of taking it away from what Maiden really was. Neither right. Steve nor I ever envisaged the band as anything other than what they were. As for Bruce's songs, they didn't fit. They had to go." Right. And Bruce Dickinson has said that the rejection of his songs at the time, quote, "left him feeling squashed for a long time." So even though Bruce Dickinson was going to stick around for, what, three more albums, and he was even going to last longer than Adrian Smith, but here we see that already at Somewhere in Time, there's pretty significant discontent from him, you know?
The thing, too, I was going to mention is that the synthesizers, there was such a anti-synthesizer thread that ran through heavy metal in the 80s, which is sort of humorous in retrospect to me now as an adult, because I look back on things like Deep Purple, which was obviously so important to the creation of heavy metal, and it was, you know, keyboards were everywhere. And you go through some of these other acts from the 70s where there was a heavy sound but keyboards, but at some point there was this, you know, this idea that, you know, heavy metal shouldn't have keyboards in it, and yet these guys did the guitar synthesizers. There was this different type of tonality to it. I think at the time, I would have thought they were synthesizers. In other words, keyboards. I don't think I would have thought of it as guitar synthesizers. Now, maybe I opened up the album eventually and saw that, but when I heard Somewhere in Time, I thought they're using synths. They're using guitar synths, but I would have kind of thought they were keyboard synths.
Yeah, looking back on it from this perspective, it's really difficult to understand why on earth they would have, you know, started using guitar synthesizers on an Iron Maiden record. Mm. But I guess at the time it made sense, or at the time it felt like it was the way to go. I don't know why they would have made that decision, but I guess you have to put yourself in their headspace in 1986. But yeah, I mean, they right away when the album starts, you hear the synthesizers very prominently, like immediately
in the
intro of the first song. So they were definitely not trying to hide it or disguise it or anything. So,
well, the first side, we can go through the songs, but the first side, as I mentioned to you, I had not listened to this record in a very, very, very long time. I'm probably a decade I had listened to it. And, you know, I'd, you know, hear songs on, if I was going through YouTube or something, I might hear a song or two, but actually listen to it front to back. I was really pleasantly surprised, or actually fairly stunned, to think how great that first side is. I mean, the first side, Somewhere in Time, Wasted Years, Sea of Madness, Heaven Can Wait, that is a great sequence of songs. And I was actually listening to it, I was going, wow, this is really amazing how great these songs are, I think, at least.
Yeah,
it's okay. I could tell you disagree. This is good. You're like, well,
only a little bit, but yeah, it. I always liked this album. Yeah, it's just trying to think about. So you've got just one guy writing. There's just one writer on almost all the songs. You've got no input from Dickinson at all, and so I guess that's why. It sounds like Iron Maiden for the most part, but there's just something, there's some kind of inspiration or vitality or something missing from a lot of it, I think. I don't know.
The lyrics?
Maybe. I mean, the idea that Martin Birch and Steve Harris are saying, no, we're just going to make the same thing over and over, you know, Bruce Dickinson's like, yeah, but we should kind of mix it up. And I guess that was probably a pretty common argument amongst bands, but you picture Steve Harris really being a stick in the mud. Like, this is, you know, there's one thing Iron Maiden is, and that's it. And Martin Birch apparently was on Steve Harris's team. You know, he was worried that Bruce and Adrian were going to try to change the band too much. But, you know, that, like we were saying, Iron Maiden was such an individual, you know, original thing that I guess that's what Martin Birch saw. And he was like, you know, why would you want to change that? You've got lightning in the bottle here with what you're doing already. So
I think it's not an uncommon dynamic within bands where you have other people who want to write, other people who want to sing. I mean, that's the other thing. I assume that none of those guys thought they should sing a song, but that's, you know, not uncommon either, where you start to get these infighting where one person in the band who feels as if they should have a different type of input into the actual songwriting or the performances on the record, and the producer is going to say, no, we have a singer, or we, you know, or no, you're not going to do this. And it's, it can lead to fracturing bands. And this is, interesting to see that, yeah, the lyrics, so I assume even the lyrics were not contributed by Dickinson.
Yeah, that was one big change. Adrian Smith used to let Bruce Dickinson write the lyrics for his songs because he didn't think he could write Maiden style lyrics. But then he started writing his own lyrics. So yeah, Bruce was even left out of that. But I was just wondering how close Bruce Dickinson was at the time to leaving the band. It sure sounds like it was really bad when they were making Somewhere in Time. And, you know, it sure seems like he just stuck around for the money. Like, you really, after reading this story, I really think more and more that, you know, one of the big problems with No Prayer for the Dying and Fear of the Dark is they're just going through the motions. As Iron Maiden became a job for some of them, you know, especially Bruce Dickinson. You know, he was just punching the clock on those records, I think, in a lot of ways. But yeah, so I guess we should jump into go track by track here on Somewhere in Time. First song, the sort of title track, caught Somewhere in Time, and like I was saying, right away, synthesizers right at the intro, about a 1 minute intro, and then the song kicks in with a great guitar melody, though, that we've been talking a lot on these episodes about the Iron Maiden, how a lot of times in this song, one of the hooks of the song is the guitar, the little guitar parts that are so great, you know, these little melodies that Steve Harris or whoever writes on for the guitar and the twin lead. This is the opening song, and I mean, I love the Time Is Always on My Side bridge, and a pretty good chorus too, but this is not as good for me as Where Eagles Dare or Ace Is High. Those songs are just in a different league to me, the songs that opened the last two albums. So I like this song, but it's definitely not in the same league as those other two for me.
Caught Somewhere in Time, the memory I'll always have associated with it is I'm almost positive they opened the tour with the show with this song, and it was, you know, blasts of lasers, and they sort of exploded onto the stage. I really like this song, as I've already sort of said that I'm kind of a fan of this album side, and I thought the melody is maybe better than I remember too, with the singing and the vocal by Bruce, and it's it's almost the second longest song in the, or the third song is long on this album, 7:22. Of course, it's a classic main kind of stretching things out. But I'm a big fan of the song, and hearing it live, it really, that was my first exposure to Maiden live, was seeing this song.
Yeah, no, this is a really good song. I just think that when, you know, you're coming off two albums where for me the album openers are so epic, and this song doesn't quite measure up to those, but, you know, I mean, I'm holding it to a pretty high standard.
Yeah,
there.
No, I mean, I think that's fair. And again, my perspective on this too, as I was trying to make earlier, is I'm not a kid who was, you know, I didn't have the Killers record the day it came out. I'm too young for that. And it just wasn't that wasn't going to be the way I got into hard rock and heavy metal anyway. And so, you know, this is me sort of like adopting, you know, Maiden post their kind of ultimate classics, what they, were best known for, those records.
Right. And, you know, I'm never a big proponent of long songs, but when it comes to Iron Maiden, a 7-minute song never feels long because they're always so well arranged, and they've got all these different riffs and guitar bits that they put in there. So it's always fun to listen to.
Yeah, and the solos too. The other thing that really struck me about listening to this album is how good the solos are. The way they structured their parts and the way they put together their solos, whether the harmony solos or trading off leads, there always were, I thought, creative and engaging to the listener. And so that was another thing I really remember. It's like, oh, you know, they were just great together, the team, the guitar team.
Yeah, just melodic guitars. That's what's so great about Long Iron Maiden songs, is you always get great guitar melodies that just, so that, you know, when you, as you listen to a 7-minute song, it doesn't feel like it's 7 minutes.
And I don't know how much Martin Birch had to do with this either, but it just seemed, even if the solos were long, to me, they never get boring. And so that's the other thing too, that really was the way they worked out their parts together. And I think clearly those guys structured their parts. They weren't just doing these spontaneous solos and then they were keeping one. It was so that the way they fit them in with the rest of the song structures were always memorable.
Right. And so the next song, Wasted Years, of course, we've already talked about how it was, it felt like it was as close as they got to a hit single at the time. I remember when this came out and hearing Adrian Smith's guitar technique on this intro, and it just sounded completely new, at least to me at the time. It was like, it wasn't like anything I'd ever heard before. And so that just instantly grabbed me. It just sounded really cool. And you're like, wow, I'm sure there have been people who had used this kind of technique in stuff before, and I've heard it since, like people putting in guitar solos and stuff.
To me, too, and I want to hear more what you think about the song, which was striking to me is when I went back into the Iron Maiden catalog, I don't remember them ever doing, and I could be wrong, so if someone's wrong, send BJ a note and complain, that they had done a sort of I'm weary of the road type of song. Like, they usually wrote about these historical themes, science fiction themes, or they wrote about different events that seemed a little bit more disconnected from their everyday life as musicians, whereas this one is a, you know, a road weary song.
Yeah, exactly. What you get is pretty personal lyrics, which, yeah, definitely not your typical Iron Maiden lyrics, which is why Adrian Smith used to have Bruce Dickinson write the lyrics for his songs. Like 2 Minutes to Midnight, he says, you know, he came up with the riffs and then Bruce wrote the lyrics, and those are some of the best Iron Maiden lyrics in my opinion. Those 2 Minutes to Midnight lyrics are amazing. And yeah, this song, I think really what makes this song fit as an Iron Maiden song is that guitar part, that weird guitar thing that he does, that I remember at the time my cousin Rob showing me how he played it, and it sure didn't look as hard as it sounded when I saw Rob doing it.
Yeah.
But it sounds so cool, and I think that's what makes this song unique. I think without that, it would feel a lot more, well, and the production, but without that, it would feel a lot more like just a straightforward hard rock song than an Iron Maiden song. But somehow, the way the song is done with that cool guitar part and just the production and everything, it really does fit, even though, yeah, like you're saying, it's a song about being, it's a rock song about being on the road. In the it really doesn't stand out. It fits in the Iron Maiden catalog, I think, very well. So even though at its core, it's not really a Maiden song so much, you know, within the sum of its parts. But I think it's amazing though. I love this song. It's really great. All the guitar thing, like we're saying, is great, and then the melodies, the chorus is awesome. So yeah, it's a great song.
You know, for me, after I really listened and went back and listened to Live After Death, and after I'd heard, I guess I'd heard Live After Death first. That's correct. Yeah, I think that's right. I'd heard Live After Death, and then this came out. I didn't like the song and some of the other stuff, only because I had already sort of imagined in my mind what Maiden was. Just the lyrics. I mean, again, the song itself is great, and it's not like I don't like the song. I do, but it just seemed like such a, it sort of, it, here's what it is. It sort of humanized them in a way that I wasn't quite, I don't know. You know, like you want to hear Ozzy sing about Iron Man and about War Pigs. You don't want to hear Ozzy singing about how he doesn't like to get up in the morning and wants to eat his oatmeal or something, you know, and, you know, whatever. It just, to me, it was sort of a, it made them more of a conventional, their themes more, much more conventional, like other songs I had heard. It's because I thought Maiden was so known for, my idea of Maiden was so known for these other themes. But, you know, that's probably nitpicking. I don't know if I'd be curious to hear if other people feel the same way or it doesn't ever even connect with them that way. But yeah, it was a very successful song for them. And I think broadened their appeal. I don't know if they sold more records after this came out, you know, in terms of their career, they probably didn't, but I think it definitely opened them up to the MTV audience in a way that made their, you know, again, their Run for the Hills wasn't going to be played in regular rotation MTV, but this song was, you know, was played.
Well, you know, what's interesting here is your reaction to this song is exactly what Martin Birch was saying he was afraid of, right? He was afraid of Bruce and Adrian, their songwriting straying too far away from what Iron Maiden was. And that's what you, when you were hearing this song, that's what was your reaction too. So that's interesting, you know.
We're going to do a song now of the new album, actually, which is called Somewhere in Time. And this is one which, this is not the one that got away this one, right? This one was out as a single quite recently. And was wandering around. It's all about being on the road and how much we, you know, most bands, they say, you know, being on the road's really terrible, all the travelling. Oh, it's really naff. We wish we couldn't do it. It's a load of rubbish, you know what I mean? It should be the best time of your life when you're up there playing the people, you know what I mean? So, I want to dedicate this one as much to you as it is to us. It's what's called Wasted Years, this one! Thank you.
So the next song, Sea of Madness, we get two songs by Adrian Smith in a row here, and this one has pretty prominent synthesizers. I definitely know that I liked this song when I was a kid, but listening to it now, it's not that great. I think it's kind of awkwardly constructed, and it doesn't have great transitions or that great of a melody. The chorus, I guess, is all right, but... And this is another... It really... I mean, you can tell... If you think about it too much and you're looking back on it now, you can hear that Adrian Smith's songwriting style is different, and yet they're trying to turn it into an Iron Maiden song. And I think you could kind of, I think you get the feeling when you listen to this song that it's a rock song being adapted into an Iron Maiden song.
In looking over the first side and thinking about this song now, this is, and I've already said, I really think the first album side is strong, and certainly strong on the second album side. It's the probably the weakest song on the first side. You know, I think the lyrics too, if you look at the lyrics, I'm not quite sure they're really anywhere near as good as some of the other lyrics that were on other Iron Maiden records. It's sort of like a Flight of Icarus sort of, I'm not quite sure what the eagle and the dove fly so high and wings above, when all you can see only brings you sadness, like a river we flow. I just don't think it's, you know, I don't think the lyrics are particularly compelling, but I do think that the chorus there, which culminates obviously with Sea of Madness, is strong.
Yeah, it's interesting. You've just got like a groove rock type riff on the verse. Yeah, I think the lyrics, you know, the lyrics are kind of struggling to be Iron Maiden lyrics.
Right.
I mean, you're right. Yeah, with these two songs here, you're completely seeing why Adrian Smith used to have Bruce Dickinson write his lyrics, and you're wondering why he stopped, I guess.
Conjured up some sort of time or space that was not really attached to my normal existence as a teenager. But you always kind of knew what they were writing about, like, you know, Iron Maiden, Acacia Avenue, these other things. If you listen to the lyrics and you've read the lyrics, you knew what the subject matter was of the song. Generally, you had some idea what it was about. But this one, I'm struggling to understand even what it's about. And so that's
right.
Really,
yeah.
You know, it just, you know, out in the street, somebody's crying. It's almost in. And then, of course, here, the line's almost like the eagle and the dove flies so high and wings above. It's almost like he's thinking, I got to write something like Flight of Icarus, you know, and it's like writing down these ideas, and they sort of come up with it. So, you know, I think the song itself, yeah, is actually brought down a bit by these lyrics, which, you know, never connected with me anyway. But now I'm like looking at them going, oh, they never connected with me, because it isn't really about anything particularly. It's just sort of phrases that sort of sound good together. And maybe someone will send you how should people reach out to you?
rockandorrollpodcast@gmail.com.
Maybe someone will send an email to rockandorrollpodcast@gmail.com and explain to me what the lyrics mean and how I'm an adult for not getting the brilliance of them. But
yeah, Sea of Madness changed my life, man.
Exactly. Maybe they will. But for me, it just isn't, it doesn't measure up.
Yeah, the best part of the song, I think, is the part after the solo, kind of the mellower part. It's got a pretty good melody where it ends, where he says, on towards the sea we go.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then it kind of kicks in again. I like that part the
most. That part, yeah, that is good.
Yeah, so the last song on side one, Heaven Can Wait. One thing that stands out to me for this album is a lot of great intros. I really like the intro parts on these songs, and this one has a great intro. And then when it kicks in, it's such a classic Maiden riff. When I was listening to this, you know, now after not having heard it probably for a while, until it gets to the chorus, it sounds like a song that could have been on one of the first two Iron Maiden albums.
Yeah.
And I had never noticed that before, but it's great. It's very up-tempo and kind of a classic Maiden sound. But then it gets to the chorus, and I just never liked the chorus. I really like the rest of the song.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I never really liked the chorus. I don't know. It just didn't connect with me.
That's interesting, because that's one of the more memorable parts of the record for me, is the chorus of that song. But lyrics, again, if you look at these lyrics, you can see how Steve Harris was a pro at writing these types of lyrics, where it's, you immediately know what it's about. It's about, you know, just you're sort of on the table. You've died, but you don't want to go to heaven. You're hoping they're going to bring you back or something like that. It's not a particularly unique theme to Iron Maiden, or even maybe that clever. But the way the lyrics are laid out with the song and the story, you know what he's trying to get at. Whereas, yeah, with some we mentioned with Sea of Madness, it's not there. So it's interesting. I really like the chorus. It's really interesting to hear you say you don't like it.
I think it's such a stark contrast from the rest of the song into the chorus, especially right. with the production, with the synth and the way Bruce, you know, Bruce starts singing it like he's on Broadway. That's how I feel. Yeah. I feel like you've got a song that could have been on Killers, and then all of a sudden you've got Bruce Dickinson just kind of, I don't know. The chorus just doesn't do it for me. And especially live. Whenever I hear this song, I picture Bruce Dickinson waving his hands the way he does live, and his legs spread. And,
yes, I can see it. Yeah, that's what he did. I'm sure that's what he did.
There's such a like theatrical nature to the chorus that doesn't. It's a very different vibe from the rest of the song, I think. I can so much hear Paul Di'Anno singing this song until the chorus. You know, that's so. And I guess this, you know, the everybody loves the sing-along part probably at the end. It might feel a little bit shoehorned. I don't know if it was I'm not really sure. It's not so great. You often wonder if the band intentionally write a part like this just for live, just so that in concert they can get the crowd singing along. You wonder if they're like, we want to have one of those parts, you know, for the concert. You know, I don't know if that's the thought process or not. Sometimes I suspect it is, though, with something like this. The song has a really cool arrangement, great guitar parts. You know, that's the thing. That's one thing that stands out for me on this album is the songs are really tightly arranged and lots of great guitar. So.
Yes. Yeah, and again, the I know I've already said this, but the solos, that was something that really stood out to me. And again, Maiden, that's what they're known for, but it's just a reminder of how they... Both of those guys just played parts that really, really made the guitar solos, which are often, you know, long. I mean, these parts, as we all know, the Iron Maiden guitar solos were not short 20-second guitar solos. These were longer parts. They really kept your interest as a fan.
Yeah, you get a lot of guitar parts that really complement the vocal melody and work almost like a vocal melody works.
Yeah.
Which, is very, very unique and just one of the things that makes long songs well worth it. For Iron Maiden, so.
Running's always been a big thing in our family. Especially running away from the police. It's hard to understand. All I know is that you've got to run. Run without knowing why, through fields and woods. And the winning post's no end, even though balmy crowds might be cheering the sends daft. That's what the loneliness of the long-distance runner feels like.
Yeah, so we flip the record over, side two, very long song title, which is The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner. So this was a short story. What was this guy's name? Silly Toe? Silly Toe was his name. The guy who wrote the story. This is one where Steve Harris took the title, but that's it, pretty much. I don't think you know, the song is just about a long distance runner, which, you know, it doesn't really have anything to do with the story, it could, besides taking the title and just the basic concept of a runner. I was reading about, I've never read that. I don't know if I ever read this story. I don't remember reading it, but it's one of, it's part of the angry young man movement in the 50s. It was about, it was a story about the struggles of the working class in post-war Britain, and a poor, bitter young man who's, he resorts to crime and then ends up in a school for delinquent youth, and he becomes obsessed with long distance running. Long distance running for him kind of evolves from a therapeutic and just an escape to eventually he uses it as a tool of rebellion and protest against the school. You know, they're given, they're, he gets special privileges, and the school, the guys that run the school or whatever, I think start, you know, they start taking pride in him as this runner, so he just loses the race on purpose just to stick it to them. You know, something like that. I mean, I'm not sure how good of a summary that is of the story, but I know it was very culturally significant at the time, and like a protest story and a story about class and you know, in post-war Britain. So none of that's in the song.
No, and I think the thing is, too, this is a Harris song, and I've just finished praising his lyrics, and of course he, you know, he's a reputation stands for himself, but it's, I read these lyrics and I even remember listening to this album as a kid and hearing this go, is this just like about jogging? You know, and I don't mean to like tear the song down totally for people who like it, but it, you know, it didn't have, again, I could have seen if I, of course, if I was advising Harris when he was writing this song, I would have said, why don't you make it about, you know, the marathons during the times of ancient Greece or something, to make it have that maiden, you could do the same type of theme, but you know, it just is sort of, you read it and it's just like, yeah, it's like when I used to have to go jogging during gym class and it would rain or something, you know, you're like, the rain's beating down your back and you're like, I want to get, you know, it's just, I don't know. It just wasn't particularly compelling in the way that I wanted maiden lyrics to be compelling. And I'm not sure if other people, you know, engage with the lyrics in that same sort of way. If it, you know, some people just are into the riffs or whatever, or it doesn't really make that much difference to them. But for me, yeah, looking at it, it's just a song about running a 6-mile race or something and just being like, yeah, it sucks because you're like pounding out the miles by yourself. And that's not what I want to listen to Maiden for.
Yeah, it's an epic song title. And it's also, it's based on a story with a lot of substance. And I think a story that was pretty famous, you know, and significant. And so there's a lot there, but he just takes the title that writes a song about jogging.
Yeah, it's about jogging, strange. Right? It's like the loneliness of Greg when he jogs in Tulsa or something. You know, it's like, I don't know. It's just, yeah, it's just not, yeah. And I think, and in fact, I didn't even know the details of the story. I had recognized the title, you know, from being something from literature. But yeah, I mean, there you go. If you're going to borrow from something, why not borrow it a little bit more, you know, more aggressively and sort of use it as a more grist for the mill about rebellion or about resistance or something, because that I could see that being, you know, much more Maiden-esque. But
or somehow at some point in the lyrics give some indication that this is a metaphor for something,
right? Yeah.
Other
exactly.
than just a literal description
exactly.
of running. Yeah,
exactly.
Yes, but as far
next
as
time
the
I go
song,
jogging, I'm gonna listen to the song and see if it inspires me.
Well, I like the song. I think it's got a great intro again. There's most of the songs on this album have really nice intros. I mean, just like pretty intros and stuff. And then, you know, it's a good song. It's a good melody. Yeah, if you're going to isolate the lyrics, it's kind of like, yeah, you know, you should have done something more with this. At least make it a metaphor, if not, you know, relate it to the story that you took the title from in some way. But, you know, if he was just writing about from the mind of the character and the story when he was running, but I don't know, it needs something more. It needs even one more line that just gives some indication that it's not just a literal description.
Yeah. I totally agree. And which brings us to the next song, and that too is borrowed from literature. They must have been doing a lot of reading in these long studio sessions. A Stranger in a Strange Land is also inspired from fiction as well.
Yeah, famous science fiction novel.
Hey,
Stater's with you think Steve Harris's tactic of
they both come into the studio to talk about their songs, and you know, I'm sure you know, Steve Harris thinks he's got this really clever idea to steal a title from a piece of literature, and looks across the room and there's like this look on his face, says, "I'm doing the same thing."
But yeah, Stranger to Strange Land, again, I don't think the song has anything to do with the book besides the title.
No, I don't think so either.
The book is about a guy who was born and raised on Mars, and then he returns to like a post-World War III Earth, and he has like superhuman intelligence and starts his own religion, and it's what, Robert Heinlein?
Yeah.
I guess, you know, it's another... I think it's similar in tone to Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner as far as it's veiled. Well, it's probably more veiled, Stranger in a Strange Land book, but I mean, the quote I read is that he uses the character's open-mindedness to reevaluate institutions like religion, money, and marriage. So he's got this guy who was raised on Mars who comes to Earth and is kind of an outcast at just looking at human society from his point of view, I guess, is kind of what the book is about. And yeah, none of that's in this song. Also interesting, the book featured the idea of the waterbed before waterbeds actually existed.
There you go. Thank God for that.
Yeah. But I don't think this is a very good song, personally. I kind of like the opening riff, but when the verse kicks in, I don't really like the verse. And I just don't think there's a lot of melody here. And this was a single, right?
I think so.
I think there was a video for this. And this is, yeah, this, like we said, this is another Adrian Smith song. I wonder how much tension there was between Adrian and Bruce when Adrian's getting all these songs on the record and he's got the singles and everything and they just shit-canned all of Bruce's songs. Yeah. I wonder if Bruce was resentful at all or not. Especially since he used to write with Adrian and here Adrian's writing by himself.
Yeah, just to give give my two cents on this on Stranger in a Strange Land, I think that the lyrics particularly are a superior to... Loneliness, and so if you're going to use the title of a piece of fiction, and again, it's about I guess about an Arctic explorer. That was the story, and again, it's if you read the lyrics and listen to the lyrics, they're much more to me. Again, kind of conjures up that maiden-esque adventure or maiden-esque escapism that I wanted from the lyrics. So I, you know, give a plug to this song to say it was one of the better lyrical performances I thought on the record.
I think they do a pretty good job of trying to set a certain kind of tone or have a certain vibe to the song that goes with the theme.
Right.
But I just don't really, as a song, I don't really like it very much.
So, and what about Deja Vu?
Deja Vu is, yeah, it's kind of dumb.
So, and what about Deja Vu?
Deja Vu is, yeah, it's kind of dumb. I like it as a song, but again, this is a these lyrics are just so literal and kind of. It's got a
yeah. I'm not a fan. I mean, I think I really do think that I'm not a particular fan of the. Well, I'll let you talk about Alexander the Great. For me, they're not. They're sort of a weak end to the record. I don't know what you think, but for me, you know, Stranger in the Strange Land is the highlight of the second side for me.
I probably like Loneliness and Deja Vu as songs more than Stranger in a Strange Land, but the lyrics to both songs are just kind of... If you focus on the lyrics, they're ridiculous, but I guess you just have to... If you're listening to the song and not focusing on the lyrics, they're decent songs. They're not great, but, you know, lyrics-wise, they're both just very literal descriptions of things without any kind of... without any other element, like we were talking about metaphor or something that would make it more interesting lyrically. I listen to a lot of music that has terrible lyrics, but it doesn't really matter. I still like the songs.
Sure.
But I guess with Iron Maiden, you hold their lyrics to a different kind of standard than you do a lot of other things. So, but yeah, I think it's an all right song, but I definitely wouldn't have much of a problem with, you know, turning this album off after... Just like you're saying, just listen to the first side or even shut it off after Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner and just, you know, call it a day on this one, maybe.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. I had forgotten that Alexander the Great has 356 to 323 BC in parentheses. It's like the ultimate like parentheses on a song for me. I'd totally forgotten that. What do you think about the song?
Yeah, that's the worst song on the record.
He was the king of a tiny kingdom. He was barely 20 when he embarked on fulfilling the longest-held dream in history, that of uniting the East and the West. A political and military genius, he conquered the greatest empire of the time, which extended up to the borders of India. In 13 years, he imposed a new vision of the world. That was 2,300 years ago. His name, Alexander the Great. From the Atlantic to the Pacific, his exploits have permeated the culture and the collective memory of many civilizations. The man, the soldier, and the politician gazes far into the future as if he were dreaming. He arrived on the world stage in 356 BC in Macedonia, 500 kilometers from Athens, which was then the capital of ancient Greece. He was born in Pella, north of Mount Olympus, the chosen land of the gods. At birth, this son of a king received the kingdom of Macedonia from his father, Philip II. Philip had united a Greek world devastated by intercity wars. It was a world of amazing artistic and intellectual richness, radiating intelligence and beauty that would give birth to Western civilization. The kingdom was small, and Alexander's ambition immense. Having inherited the spirit of his father, he succeeded in spreading Greek thinking far and wide. His genius was underpinned by brilliant strategic and political intuition. At a time when professional armies did not exist, he formed a permanent army with veritable professional troops. This offered a considerable advantage over his enemies, who would arm peasants, who would then return to their harvest when the war was over. During this period in history, the majority of Asia was under the influence of the powerful Persian Empire. The Persians had twice unsuccessfully tried to invade Greece. The Greeks, for their part, wanted to retaliate in memory of the Greek cities of Asia Minor, the present-day Turkey, which had fallen into the hands of the Persians. Alexander's appeal was received with fervor throughout the Greek world, and he was able to embark on one of the most dazzling adventures ever envisaged by man. It would turn him into a demigod.
I again applaud the effort to try to tap into the maiden themes that I enjoy, and I know I've been obsessed with the lyrics, but I just think that for me, it's as somebody who has applauded the first side as being strong and really enjoying the first side of the record, I think it's sort of it doesn't speak well for the whole record when you listen to the second side. And that's kind of surprising with Maiden because, in the past, of course, their records had been so consistently, like a Power Slave or something like that. It's like kick ass from front to back. And so.
Yeah, I wrote down this song as To Tame an Ancient Mariner because it's really just, it's so obviously trying to be that
yes.
song. And
yes.
so it becomes a parody of itself. It really does. Right. And like I said about To Tame a Land too, too many words makes the whole thing cumbersome because there's not a melody when you're just chanting words because you're trying to fit all the information in. That's not really a song.
Right.
There's really nothing good. I mean, there's probably, if you're going to slog your way through the song, I'm sure there's good guitar parts and cool riffs, but it's not worth it.
Yeah.
It's not worth listening to the song to hear that stuff. It just doesn't work really on any level at all. And in the end, it seems so forced and just trying to be that epic last song Do you think we should talk about Alexander the Great at all, or
the song?
The actual guy. I did a little bit of research about him. I mean, it's interesting. I saw he was tutored by Aristotle until he was 16. So that's pretty good tutor to have. But yeah, I was going to say about Alexander the Great, in my research, what I found funny is that, you know, conspiracy theories go back a long time, because there's even a conspiracy theory about the death of Alexander the Great, of whether or not he was poisoned.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's so funny that Steve Harris just ignores that, and just the end of the song is like, he had a fever and he died. and it would have been kind of interesting if he just, you know, addressed the conspiracy theory, or the debate over whether or not he was poisoned and murdered.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, I just am coming away with the memory of, yeah, it's just at the time, I don't think I would have thought about whether the second side wasn't as good as the first. I probably thought about it, but it didn't like make me think Maiden. You don't think like Maiden's on the decline or there's problems in the Maiden camp. You just think, oh, I don't like this record as much as the other record, but Maiden rules, you know, I love Maiden, or Maiden's great. And so it's you can kind of see the cracks, as you pointed out very well, cracks starting in the foundation there of the Maiden edifice.
Yeah, and in retrospect, they probably should have put a couple of those Bruce Dickinson songs on here.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, so there you have it. Somewhere in Time, side one a lot better than side two, right? And thanks a lot, Greg, for doing this, for you know, taking time out of your busy schedule again to indulge me in another conversation about.
I enjoyed it. Yeah, and it was a good trip down memory lane. And as we've been saying, if you don't like what we think about the record, please email BJ and complain. or compliment. I shouldn't complain. I always assume that people are going to be so fanatical about Maiden. It's like, I'm not as fanatical as some fan of some of the other people. So maybe I've said some horrifically wrongheaded and mean spirited things about this record, and I'd love to be corrected.
I don't think we did too much trash talk. I guess somebody could say, hey, I love songs about jogging. What's your problem? But yeah.
Well, thanks again, BJ. It was a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, Greg.
And now, to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you with the B-side of the Wasted Years single. This song was actually written by a guy named Dave Caldwell. And he was playing with Adrian Smith and Nico McBrain in a side project called The Entire Population of Hackney that played a couple of live shows, featured former members of Urchin, Adrian Smith's band before Iron Maiden. And Caldwell would go on to form the band ASAP, which stands for Adrian Smith and Project, with Adrian Smith once he left Iron Maiden. And that band would also feature former member, at least one former member of Urchin. So this song was written by Dave Caldwell, and it had been performed live by the entire population of Hackney, that side project that Adrian and Nico had before the release of Somewhere in Time, I believe. So check it out. It does not sound like an Iron Maiden song, but it sure sounds like a song that I would like, and I do. I think it's great. Anyone who has listened to any of my AOR, AOK episodes will, this song will sound familiar in style to a lot of what you hear on those episodes. So if you haven't heard it before, enjoy it. This is Reach Out, sung by Adrian Smith, written by Dave Caldwell, B-side to the Wasted Years single. Till next time. It's over your head, and you don't seem to understand a word I said. And you can't live your life trying to run away.
I'll be back.